This is the 20-Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and I'm very excited for this episode today. The best for me are always when you move completely away from the schedule and you talk about the things that really matter. Happiness, learning, ambition, vulnerability. And this was a special episode in that respect as we welcome Josh Silverman, CEO at Etsy, where he leads the company as it builds a platform that empowers creative entrepreneurs around the world. And prior to their IPO, Etsy raised funding from some of the best in the business, including Danny Reimer at Index, Albert Wenger at USV, and Jim Breyer at Excel, to name a few. Prior to Etsy, though, Josh served as President of Consumer Products and Services at American Express. He was also the CEO of Skype and CEO of Shopping.com, and he also held various executive roles at eBay. Josh is also currently on the board of directors at Shake Shack, if he wasn't cool enough. And then finally, I do want to say a huge thank you to Danny Reimer and Katarina Fake for some fantastic question suggestions today. I really do so appreciate that. But before we dive into the show today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList's fund admin platform to manage my investments with 20VC. The team and the platform at AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products that allow you to do things that you simply didn't think were possible before, in 2021, every business is a global business. But how do you pay your global team and comply with international labor laws? Well, Remote handles payroll, benefits, taxes, and compliance to help companies of all sizes to pay and manage full-time and contract workers all over the world, no matter where your team lives and works. Remote's global employment solutions keep your team, your finances, and your IP secure. Remote never charges percentages or fees, just best-in-class global employment solutions for a low flat rate. The world's top companies love Remote. GitLab, the world's largest all-remote organization, trust Remote to manage their global team, and Remote is funded by Index Ventures, Sequoia, and a host of other top-tier investors. I'm very proud to call myself a Remote investor. And ready to learn more? Well, visit remote.com/20VC today to download Remote's latest research report and start employing in minutes. And as I said, speaking of game-changing products with Remote to use at your company, we've all heard that time is money, and so Ramp says, why don't you save both? Ramp is the only spend management platform and corporate card that can really automate your account and lower your bills in under 15 minutes. That's even less than the 20VC podcast, my word. And Ramp allows you to streamline approvals, controlling spend before it happens. Ramp also has this awesome feature where it automatically identifies all active subscriptions and upcoming payments, allowing you to forecast in real time. For these and many more reasons, some of the best use Ramp, including 8 Sleep, Row, Founders Fund, and more. To join the revolution of saving both time and money with Ramp, head over to ramp.com. But that's quite enough from me, so now I'm very excited to hand over to Josh Silverman, CEO at Etsy.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Josh, it is such a joy to have you on the show today. I heard so many great things from Danny Reimer at Index before the show, so thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Not at all, but I do want to start with some context. So tell me, how did you make your way into the world of startups that we both love so much, and most importantly, now come to be CEO at Etsy?
Oh gosh, there certainly wasn't a plan. I started out as a public policy major in college with a deep passion for fixing the healthcare system in the United States. And I went to work for a senator for a couple of years in Washington, D.C., answering mail and writing policy positions and sort of worked my way up from there. But I ended up as a management consultant, realized that isn't what I wanted to do, and really felt like the best way to have a positive impact on my community was to run a business. I think when you run a business, you're able to really move much more quickly than in policy, and I think do a lot of things that can positively impact community. So yeah, I ended up getting a very respectable job out of business school and quit that to go try to start my own thing, which I was lucky enough to also fall in with Selena Tabakawala and Al Lieb, and we did Evite together. And from there, I think my career has mostly been having the privilege to go into companies that have had a really good first act and figure out how to unlock a really successful second act.
Yeah. Before we kind of touch on the transition from first act to second act, do you have to ask, you said there about the kind of background and also the political elements. Danny Reimer said about your kind of innate curiosity across many different realms. And he said, like, did you always think that you'd be running a multi-billion dollar company. And how do you think those experiences prepared you to be the CEO you are?
I certainly didn't. I mean, if you'd asked the young me, the Josh Silverman in high school, I was going to be a professional jazz musician. And then in college, I was going to be an actor. And I think I am where I am today to some extent because I was so untalented in the performing arts that I had to fall back on something else. But I think what has been true of me is I didn't have a plan that said 20 years from now, I want to be this. I've tended to measure my life out in 3 to 4 year sprints. Over the next 3 to 4 years, what would be a great accomplishment I could be really proud of? And then I've poured myself in with no reservation and a tremendous amount of passion to get to that 3 to 4 year milestone. And in picking what those milestones would be, you know, mostly it's, do I think I would learn a ton? Would I work with amazing people? And would it give me skills that are transferable and useful that expand my optionality rather than constrain my optionality? And using that as a metric has been helpful. I think this notion that you've got to figure out what you're going to do for the next 20 years can be so overwhelming. And life has so much luck and fate involved that if you hang everything on some 20-year aspiration, the probability that something is going to derail you is great. 3 to 4 years at a time, that's kind of an amount of time I can actually get my head around and try to manage and have a lot of agency into the outcome.
Can I ask you advice? I like the longer-term plan because, and for no other reason than I like the mental security that it may be naive and ignorant to me, but I feel, oh, I know where I'm going for 10 or 20 years, and 3 or 4 feels a little bit vulnerable for me. Like, how do you deal with that mental security that comes from the longer? And how would you advise me given that?
I feel like the world changes so quickly now that any 10-year plan you have is unlikely to follow through in the way that you wanted. So I think you're feeling a false sense of security. You know, as Mike Tyson once said, everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yeah.
And in the course of any 10-year time, you're going to get punched in the face multiple times. So where I find security is thinking, if I can accomplish something really meaningful over this next 3 to 4 years, really meaningful that I can be really proud of, and I can do it with a group of people that I really respect and admire, and in doing so, I'm going to gain a whole new set of skills. That's going to position me super well for whatever comes. Come what may in the world, I will be better positioned for having done that.
Yeah. Can I ask, what do you do when, and sorry, we have a schedule and we're just totally ignoring it, but this is too helpful. Yeah. When you have two options in front of you and you just don't know, as you said, the world is ever changing. The complexities within each are often quite opaque and it's not as transparent as one thinks. What do you do when you don't know and you're weighing those two?
My life has been punctuated by a series of inflection points where I've taken the job most people thought I shouldn't take. And so figuring out how to balance risk and opportunity is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. In fact, I think every job I've ever had in the past 20 years, I've gotten because most other people wouldn't take it. You know, I mean, when they asked me to run Skype, I was at eBay. Honestly, they spent 4 months looking to find anyone else and no one would take that job because, you know, it's in the telecommunications industry, which is highly regulated, and international phone calls were going to zero, you know, becoming free. And Skype was really built around the whole world can talk for free. Etsy, you know, was in a very challenging position, you know, on and on. Each of those jobs, you know, everyone I asked for their opinion said, oh, for God's sake, don't do that. But when I looked at Skype, when I looked at Etsy, what those companies do for their customers, what they do for the world is so important and so valuable that I felt like we could build something great. If it worked, my team and I would cover ourselves in glory. And so thinking about the upside and the downside path, I tend to be very deliberate about thinking, what if it goes well and what if it doesn't? And, you know, if it goes well, it needs to be really meaningful. I need to have learned a lot and created an accomplishment that I can feel really proud of. And if it doesn't go well, you know, if I'm looking at Skype and Etsy both in particular, these are companies that at the time that I joined, both were really foundering. And, you know, the truth is, if it didn't go well, hey, we took a shot, you know, and we were handed a tough deck of cards and you know, we did our best, and I'm sure I would have learned some things. But man, if we can do something with, let's take Etsy, which, you know, 4 million sellers count on Etsy every day to feed their families and to connect with community. That's so meaningful. That's so special. You know, who wouldn't want the chance to go and try to help?
Can I ask, how do you think about downside protection? It's often the thing that, I shouldn't admit this being a VC, but I actually, you know, when I think about my relationship to risk, I do think a lot about downside protection. You say, you know, we tried and it would have been great. great. Yeah, I agree. But there's not much downside protection to that. Like,
yeah, it's so true. And there's a real difference between a VC and an entrepreneur. I mean, a VC has a portfolio of bets.
Yeah.
An entrepreneur has literally put everything on 32 Red, right? This one company is your entire success. I mean, look, I've said no to a lot more opportunities than I've said yes to. And the difference is, do I genuinely believe that what this company does is really important to its customers and fundamentally misunderstood by them? Much of the time, I think the answer is, you know, when presented with a company in bad shape, I think that what they do isn't that unique or important and it's well understood by the world. But there's times when I have a real contrarian point of view. You know, when joining Etsy, people thought it was a niche, small marketplace for handmade thing. It was sort of kitschy, cute little thing. And in fact, I think that many people inside the company had thought, wow, Etsy has sort of achieved all it can achieve with its core marketplace. Now let's go launch a bunch of new things. And my perspective was, in a world that's becoming ever more commoditized and where automation is changing the nature of work, creativity can't be automated. And we're going to yearn more and more for something made just for us. The more the world centers on Amazon, the more we desperately desire an alternative to Amazon. And I can't think of any company better positioned to be the alternative to Amazon than Etsy. And so I don't think it's niche at all. I think it's massive. I just don't define the market as handmade. I define the market as special. We at Etsy define the market as special. If you want something which feels special, which feels like it was made just for you, where you've connected with the actual person who made it, that's what you come to Etsy for.
You mentioned kind of having that contrarian view. I'm really interested because, you know, as you said, it was a tougher time when you joined Etsy and when you took over the CEO role. And the kind of thinking of those tougher times, famous saying, never let a good crisis go to waste. I'd love to hear your thoughts. How do you think about that? And bluntly, those times when it is tougher, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, a phrase I use a lot, never let a good crisis go to waste. And many leaders get paralyzed in a time of crisis, but it's actually incredibly liberating. When the only alternative to success is abject failure, it focuses the mind. When staying the course results in the company, you know, not existing anymore, you're given tremendous permission. In many ways, the risk of change has dropped tremendously. And I think there's a couple of things that I've learned to really focus on. The main thing is keeping the main thing the main thing. So what does success look like, and what are the fewest things we need to do to succeed? And how do we then clear the path and get rid of all of the noise in order to just do those few things? The other thing I've observed in companies that have achieved some level of success is they confuse that they've succeeded because of and the things they've succeeded in spite of. What the company has done has become lore, and we've got to keep doing that. And in fact, for any company, you've achieved success because of a certain set of things and in spite of a certain set of things. Many companies don't really stop to reflect deeply on parsing out the difference. And a time of crisis can give you a chance to really do that. An example is at Etsy. Etsy believed that because Etsy was about handmade, Etsy should make everything itself. So Etsy didn't use the cloud and built almost all of its software itself. And that was sort of lore. It was considered strategy, but I don't think it was strategy. It was just dogma. And it was dogma that was, in fact, holding the company back in many, many ways.
Everything you say, Josh, there seems to be kind of many elements for me to unpack and dive into. The first was, you mentioned kind of like success and like, what does success look like? I often ask myself this, and then I set the bar, and then I get to that bar and I'm like, oh, well, I'm still not happy. So my question to you is like, how do you think about happiness connoted to that success bar? And is success like that defined point? Do you know what I mean? How do you connote happiness to that point?
Are you speaking about your own personal happiness? Like what brings fulfillment to you?
Yeah, actually.
Yeah. I mean, happiness, you normally, I don't know, in my experience, I don't often have happiness in the moment. I have happiness in hindsight. When I feel like we have achieved something of great purpose, at the end of my life, I will reflect back and determine that I was happy. Although along the way, it may not have felt that way all the time, because to achieve purpose is often to put yourself in positions of stress, making very difficult decisions, acting with a lot of urgency, making a lot of choices. in your life. But that's what causes accomplishment, which leads to fulfillment, which ultimately I think is happiness. I mean, I think in terms of my role leading Etsy, we try to think hard about what does success look like for our customers and therefore what is success for us. And I think if we can achieve that together, we can find a lot of fulfillment. And I think we can do it while having good balance with our personal lives as well. And I think that is also very important.
Yeah, no, I agree with you in terms of the importance around balance. The other was when you said about kind of the dogma and knowing when to disregard it. When dogmas worked for you, or like a set of practices has worked for you in the past, how do you know when to shed versus when to keep them with that in mind moving forward?
So there's often a lot of gold hiding under the sacred cow. One of the first things I've done when coming into a company is look at what their core beliefs are and inspect whether that core belief is actually adding value or not. You know, earlier in my career, I had the privilege of running a company called Marktplaats in the Netherlands, which was sort of the Craigslist of the Netherlands, but bigger and more successful. And it had grown to be, you know, the dominant marketplace in the Netherlands. And so the team believed that everything they did made it that way. One of the things that they really believed was that super fast page load times mattered, which of course we all believe. And therefore, they only allowed 3 photos and the photos had to be low res thumbnails. And the reason is, and that sort of low res thumbnail was enshrined almost as though Moses had come down from the mountain with thou shalt have low res thumbnail, you know, inscribed on a tablet. And, you know, at the time that the company was founded, people connected to the internet through dial up largely. And by the time we bought the company, almost everyone in the Netherlands had broadband internet access. And, you know, so we tested what happens if you use high res photos and a lot more of them. And of course it drove conversion rate. But believe it or not, it was very controversial inside the company to do that. So in some ways, the things that people are unwilling to test or experiment with are often the things that are most valuable to test and experiment with. When I got to Etsy, there was a lot of resistance to moving to the cloud. Again, we at Etsy are, you know, we are handmade. And so we run on bare metal and we do it ourselves. And, you know, Etsy has a wonderful engineering culture and terrific engineers. But a lot of those engineers had earned their stripe by having the best sort of bare metal operations in the world. And yet you look around and say, everyone else has moved to the cloud. So either we know something they don't or we're missing something. And I want the chance to inspect whether, in fact, we're missing something. There tended to be, and I find this often, an embracement of difference. We want to be different than everyone else. And I think that there's an iconoclastic spirit in that that I love. But I'll challenge my team. I want to be better than everyone else. And so if you can't tell me why different makes us better, I'm not that interested.
Can I ask, as a leader, what's the right way to challenge dogma and ingrained principles? Is it to come in and say, hey, that was the past, this is the future? Is it gradual, hey, we should think about this? How do you think about that transition process and how binary it should be?
I think the most important thing is to orient everyone around a mission that you all have shared belief in. If you're going to take the team through very hard times, which building any business over time, you're going to go through hard times together, you all have to have a shared belief in something bigger than yourselves and something bigger than the stock price or the market cap. So what is it that we are doing for our community at large and our customers that is so important that we should spend the hours we do on it, take the personal risk we do? You know, getting back to your question about happiness and risk, I don't want to spend a lot of time on any endeavor in life that I don't think will have a purpose greater than myself. So finding that key purpose is important. And then when you frame everything in terms of service to that purpose, it becomes a lot easier to stomach all of the change we're making and questioning our own beliefs. So at Etsy, worked hard to figure out what that purpose was. And it's keeping commerce human. That's our mission. It's keeping commerce human. And in a world that's becoming more commoditized and less human, we think that's really important. And we frame everything in terms of service to our sellers. We have 4 million sellers right now. And, you know, you want to know why politics is so fraught. Life's not that easy for them. And, you know, the few of us that are lucky enough to work at Etsy, we've got high paying jobs and beautiful offices and a time when we can return to offices and nice benefit plans and all the things that come with working for a tech company. But our sellers are out there without almost any of those benefits. And so we've got to think hard about every decision we make. And is it something that's going to make them better and lift them up?
I'm really interested when you say about kind of the core there and what really matters, and then kind of tying that back to the team. I spoke to Reiner on your team before the show, and she said that a I had to ask about the vital few versus the worthwhile many. It was our number one suggestion. Talk to me about vital few versus worthwhile many and how you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, on most teams, I think there's a desire to look around and look at for good ideas and say, what are good ideas? And let's go do those. And I think that bar is far too low. I mean, if it's a good idea, it's aligned with your strategy, it's likely to have a positive return, and you're proud to get up in front of the board and tell the board that you're doing this, you know, often the company will say, let's do it. But if you do all of the ideas that meet that criteria, you're dead in the water. There's far too many of them. So instead of asking, what good ideas do we have? I try to ask, and I think we at Etsy try to ask ourselves, what are the fewest things we need to do in order to win? What are the fewest best ideas? And in order to do that, you have to start by defining winning. What is winning? What does it mean to win? And how do I measure winning? And once you've done that, you can then say, well, if that's what winning is, what are the fewest things we need to do in order to achieve that goal? So at Etsy, you know, keeping commerce human is our mission. For me, the metric of success, winning, is all about GMV. GMV is the sum sales of our sellers. How much did our sellers sell this year? That's different than our revenue. Our revenue is a subset of that, and our profit is a subset of our revenue. But our seller sales, or GMV, is the metric of their success. It's, are our customers winning? It's how big is the pie? And if that pie is getting bigger, everything else takes care of itself. So when we say we want to, let's say, double GMV over the next 3 years, just to pick up an example, what are the fewest things we need to do to double GMV over the next 3 years? Is very different than what are the good ideas we have to grow GMV. And it gives us permission to say no to a whole bunch of things. So the long list of good ideas is the worthwhile many. The few of those that we are actually going to commit to and do is the vital few.
Can I ask, when you then identify the vital few and you actually have real definition and focus around the strategic pathway forward, and you think about the team around you, you know, you said before about the importance of delegating without abdicating. What did you mean specifically by that? And how do you think about effective delegation in particular?
So I worked for Ken Chenault at American Express, and he taught me leadership is about defining success and defining constraints. And the more I've been on my journey, the more I realize it's those two things plus one. I would add one thing, which is making sure you have the right people on the team. But if a leader does only those things, define success, define constraints, and make sure you have the right people on the team, everything else takes care of itself. When I was earlier in my career, I thought my job was to have good ideas and be a good problem solver. And it was something I was good at. And so I tended to lean on it. And, you know, I quickly scaled out of that. So it sounds easy, does hard. Define success and define constraints. There's an art and a science to it. But the better you can do as a leader of clearly defining what success and constraints look like, and then getting out of the way to allow your team to innovate to achieve that goal, the better you will do. I'll give you an example. When I took over at Skype, Meg Whitman was the CEO of eBay, which owned Skype at the time. And she had sort of talked a lot about Skype 4.0 was this new platform Skype was going to launch that was going to, you know, change the trajectory and fortunes of Skype. Skype was sort of decelerating and declining rapidly. And so I was put in as the new CEO. And the first thing I did was convene my team. And I got the leaders of Skype 4.0 in a room, the person who headed product and engineering and quality and design, et cetera. And I asked each one of them the same question, what are we solving for with Skype 4.0? And I had 8 people in the room and I had 8 answers. And the team was evenly divided. Half of them thought we would never ship Skype 4.0 because we couldn't get out of our own way. And half of them thought we should never ship Skype 4.0 because it was a terrible idea that was going to kill the company. And it was not what I expected, to say the least. But, you know, I ended up writing a 1-paragraph mission statement for what Skype 4.0 would do. I said, Skype 4.0 will be measured by driving engagement. We're going to dramatically inflect engagement in our platform. We have only until December 31st to ship it, and nothing is allowed to get in its way. And here are the risks you're allowed to take. And I let them, almost anything they wanted to do, they could do. We were going to bet the company on this thing. But in one paragraph, crystallized for them exactly how they should define what they were solving for, how much time they had, how many people they had. And through that process, the team, you know, we together discovered that pivoting Skype from audio calls to video calls was probably the most powerful way to drive engagement. And so we made video calling the centerpiece of Skype 4.0, changed Skype's brand, really, and mission to be about video, shipped an amazing product by December 31st, and dramatically changed the growth curve of the business. And I think introduced video calling to the world in a really powerful way. And it wasn't me saying, I think video calling is the future. I'm some brilliant product genius. And it was me defining what mattered to save the company was driving engagement in the platform, reinvigorating engagement in the platform. And the team spending time with customers, looking at the landscape and deciding that video was the best way to do that. And then going all in.
Can I ask, when you go in and you think about the delegation, but most importantly, accountability, how do you put that very strong accountability on individuals within the team without also creating fear of, you know, we're betting the whole company on this transition? No pressure, let's deliver.
So important. So figuring out milestones along the way, delegation is not abdication. And so saying you have until December 31st to do it doesn't mean you go away and come back on December 31st. What are the milestones along the way and the breadcrumbs that we need to see? I talked to my team about proof of the future today. We have this future vision. What proof can we find of that vision today? And so if I'm thinking about the Skype example, you know, Skype had a real aversion to metric, to tracking things. There was a strong sort of libertarian privacy element within Skype, but it meant that we couldn't really get data on what our customers used and valued. And so I said, we're going to wire Skype 4.0 to allow us to understand anonymously our customers' usage patterns. And then we're going to ship alpha, 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 which is something we hadn't been in the habit of doing as much at Skype. And so we're going to ship multiple pre-releases to early populations to get evidence of whether the great ideas that you all have as a leadership team are actually taking root, so that by the time December 31st comes, we've de-risked the notion. At Etsy, the way we do it is we're organized in squads. The unit of work at Etsy is a squad. A squad is about 10 people, 6 engineers, a designer, a product manager, an analyst, roughly. And they're given one customer problem to fix and one metric of success. And so that might be customers don't know when their packages are going to arrive with enough reliability. Your job is to make customers have confidence in when their package is going to arrive. For example, you have a year, and by the end of the year, you need to have unlocked $50 million of GMS in doing so. So the things you do must unlock. So now they've got a clear idea of the customer problem, how they measure success, and how much time they have. Go. Now, every month, my leadership team and I meet with each of these squads and get a progress update. And it's not unusual that over the course of the month, they will have shipped. Typically, a squad is going to ship 2 or 3 experiments a month at least. And it's not unusual that everything they did that month failed. But some months they have great success. And so once a month, we have a monthly metrics meeting where each leader stands and reports on what their teams have accomplished. And there's a lot of public accountability in that. But we also work together as a portfolio. And what you see is in any given month, a few squads have had great months and a few squads have had not great months. And over the balance of the squads, we generally do quite well, and we support each other, and it allows us all to take risks because we've made the cost of failure fairly low. And if a squad goes 4, 5, and 6 months and has not had success, we start to ask ourselves, maybe this path isn't that fruitful. Maybe this customer problem isn't as important to our customers as some other customer problem. It's not unusual to make some pivots and changes and ask those squads to work on different problems.
At what stage do you ask whether it's the individual or the team?
When the quality and creativity and boldness of the ideas are not adequate. A team can fail 4 or 5 months in a row, and I will hold them in great esteem. 6 months, 7 months in a row, and I will hold them in great esteem. There are teams that have delivered close to 0 over the course of the year, and I hold them in great esteem because their ideas are bold and grounded in good customer insight. What I find challenging is teams that are timid or not grounded in their customers.
No, I totally agree with you in terms of the boldness of the ideas. One thing that is potentially challenging with the monthly check-ins and the accountability that I've found is, like, actually, you're not always going to be loved. You know, it's much easier being the happy-go-lucky, for me, you know, charismatic, good-looking English chap. that's self-proclaimed, by the way, sadly. But, like, you know, fundamentally, you do sometimes have to not be Mr. Nice Guy and not be afraid to be disliked. How do you think about getting comfortable with not being loved or liked by everyone? That's my biggest challenge.
I'm an empathetic person. I think most of us who are leaders are empathetic people. And so we like to be liked. I like to be liked. I think if decisions are made transparently with the customer's interests leading first, people will respect those decisions, even when those decisions are difficult. We've made a lot of very difficult decisions at Etsy, and I'm sure that I was not well liked in the beginning. You know, we had to lay off over 200 people. You know, within 5 weeks of joining the company, we'd laid off 20% of the staff, and of the remaining staff, probably 80% of them had new jobs. And we'd shut down over half of all the projects that the company was working on. It was tremendously disruptive to people's lives, and it was very difficult. And I'm sure that I wasn't winning a lot of popularity awards at the time. But I said from the beginning, this is about lifting up our sellers and serving them better. And we're going to have to go do a lot of hard things. But there are bigger things at stake than our own feelings. We can all feel happy and content with ourselves and fail our sellers, and we won't have served anyone, and we won't feel much satisfaction later in life looking back. So what I think we've done fairly well as a team is transparently share why did we make the decisions we made and what did we consider in making those decisions. One thing I do a lot with my team is red hat, green hats. So when making difficult decisions, we very explicitly we'll have a red hat, green hat, and challenge ourselves on those decisions and then come to an answer. And for any difficult decision you make, there's going to be a group of people who don't agree with you. But if they know that their point of view was heard, and if they can actually hear you articulate it back, here are the four things about this decision that are risky. Here are the four things about this decision that may not work or that would lead you to go a different direction. If they can hear me articulate their points of view authentically, I think it goes a long way to building trust. At least I was heard, and that matters a lot. The other thing I'd say is it does matter to be right more often than wrong. None of us are right all the time, and I'm certainly wrong my share of the time, but I'm willing to pivot. You know, we've made a lot of pivots in our time, too. When we don't get it right, we're willing to own it, acknowledge it, and change and move on. And I think for any leader, you know, you got to have enough judgment that you are right more often than wrong, because you've got to earn the trust and confidence of your team. And I think a lot of that does come with experience.
Can I ask one big misnomer I think we have in tech, especially, is like we kind of idolize failure in many respects. And we say, oh, you learn so much from failure. And actually, you know, success is great, but you don't actually have that many learnings from it. I always disagree quite strongly. I think people just don't spend the time doing postmortems on successes when they do failures. How do you think about that you learn more from failure than success? And what's your experience been with the two and the subsequent learning?
Well, I mean, if you're not succeeding often enough, you don't have a right to continue, right? You could have a lot of learnings if all you do is fail, but at the end of the day, you're not going to have anything. I think your point about not doing postmortems on success is a fascinating one. And this notion, I think that gets back to that we succeeded in spite of the following, you know, because of the following things, but in spite of the following things. That's a great process to put in place to try to unpack that. I think that setting up a system, the notion that it's great to fail, setting up a system where failure is affordable and picking when you can fail are too important. If you're going to embrace failure, you've got to have those two things in place. So on the first one, you know, at Etsy, we do have a really agile software development system where, you know, in general, we can go from idea to live to site in a couple weeks. And we test it in front of 50% of the population, 50% sees the old, you know, the old version. And if it doesn't work, we roll it back. And so the opportunity cost of failure for most things is quite low. So we can afford to fail and get learnings. Now, one of the things we do with every experiment that fails, and by the way, we do, you know, tens of experiments per week. For every experiment that fails, we ask ourselves, could we have learned this faster and cheaper? So often we'll look at an experiment that we launched and say, you know what, we could have probably done a paper prototype in front of six customers and gained the same learning. We didn't need six engineers to spend a week and a half coding this thing and then put it up in front of 4 million people to learn that. And so we constantly go back and say, was there a cheaper and faster way to gain this learning than the way we did? But the second decision matrix that I use a lot actually is a 2x2 framework of the importance of the decision and the cost of rollback. And if you think about each decision you make in terms of how important is it and what's the cost of rollback, there's a relatively few things that are both very important and very difficult to roll back. Those are things where failure is really not a good option. A pricing change is a very common example of that. If you get a pricing change wrong, it can have a dramatic impact on your customer base for a very long time. And so we are extremely deliberate about pricing changes. We do mountains of research because we really can't afford to fail. On many other things, you know, the cost of rollback is very low. So something can be both very important but have a very low cost of rollback? What the heck? Ship it. Ship it. Don't spend a lot of time perseverating over it. Just ship, ship, ship. You'll get it.
I totally agree with you. It reminds me of kind of sink the boat versus non-sink the boat decision making. I love that kind of framework and matrix. So final question for the quickfire. It's like when you think about the frameworks and matrix like that, that you have now as a CEO, when you compare yourself to your former years as a CEO, you know, I'm sure you've changed immensely. How have you changed as a CEO, do you think, over the last 10 to 15 years?
Oh, I think the poor folks who worked with me at Evite wouldn't recognize me. And I hope 10 or 15 years from now, I'll look back at my current self and say, oh my gosh, I'm so much better. I mean, I definitely see myself as a work in progress. And I think of myself as a craftsperson in the craft of leadership. I'm constantly trying to hone and refine my craft and get better. And a couple of things, I'm a very active role modeler. I'm a voracious reader. I read biographies all the time. And I try to go meet all kinds of impressive leaders. And not just impressive leaders you read about in the paper. Every person I work with, I learn something from. The people who work with me at Etsy are amazing, incredible people. And every person I work with, there's some quality they have that I admire that they do better than me. And I'm constantly looking at what can I learn from this person and how they handle this situation or how they think about this craft or how they ask those questions and think, how can I start to incorporate that? The second thing that's been very helpful for me is times for real contemplation. I've had a couple of periods in my life where I've had, you know, 3 months off, 5 months off, and the chance to reflect back on my work and think, what would I have done differently with the most critical eye? Those have been incredibly valuable and painful. You know, looking back at every prior job, I will look back and say, these are 3 or 4 places where I, as a leader, really needed to evolve. And as painful as those reflections are, they've made me much better.
Final thing, I promise, and then, you know, you can invoice me for your advice later. When you look at those places where you need to evolve, I analyze a lot of what I do and I'm like, shit, I really need to evolve here. And then some people go, no, fuck that. You can hire someone to do that. Just focus on what you're great at. Just focus on that. And then other times I think, no, that's idealistic. How do you determine between fundamentally need to evolve versus not a core competency, can delegate or hire?
I think there's table stakes and there's your spikes or strengths, right? So whatever your job is, there's table stakes good enough. I'm not a project manager by nature. It's not what I'm great at. But to be an effective CEO, there's a table stakes level of project management that I need to have and be capable of. And I've worked hard to get to table stakes. I'm not saying I'm going to be great. And I surround myself with people who are much better at that than me. But if I don't have some level of orientation around operations, I won't have enough empathy for the people on my team who really need to do that and make that work. And then I do try, try to learn more and more what are the things that I'm uniquely good at and how can I leverage those more and bring those more into the company. But I think this notion that only focus on your strengths and sort of let yourself off the hook on all your weaknesses, I don't know. I don't love that. I know I always want to evolve. I always want to get better. I'm a continuous work in progress. And I just don't think I'm capable of that.
I agree. It reminds me of the advice of like, no one really knows what they're doing, so don't worry about it. And it's like, well, actually, there's a lot of people that do know what they're doing. It's completely ridiculous advice.
Yes. And especially if you're a leader. I mean, I don't know. I feel like all of us are leaders in our own roles, but if you have the privilege to lead a whole company, there's a lot of people whose livelihoods are at stake. You know, it feels tremendously flippant to say, well, I'm just going to like focus on what I do. You know what? Like, this is about way more than me. You know, I have a lot of responsibility and I owe it to the people who count on me to try to be the best I can.
Do you feel the weight of that responsibility? I feel it now with the fund and with LPs. Do you feel the weight with your employees and your customers?
Of course. I think that's so healthy. Like, thank God I feel the weight. Of course I should feel the weight. You know, I think that's what motivates us and drives us. And I think it's a great thing.
Josh, I could talk to you all day. So let's do a quick fire round. And so I say a short statement and then you give me your immediate thoughts. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay. So favorite book and why? What must I be reading?
I read about 50 books a year because Audible has changed my life. So I listen to books. Right now, I'm listening to a biography of Ulysses Grant. And what I love about it is he's someone who could fade into any background. I mean, he's the general who led the Union to win the Civil War in the United States. And we have this notion of generals being these larger than life, charismatic personalities. And he was the opposite of that. He was the wallpaper in which you'd fade into in any room. And 2 years prior to leading 1 million soldiers in the war, He was a shop clerk in a leather store, and the junior shop clerk, and not a good one at that. He had failed as a farmer. So in any other role, he was a total failure. But in the right place at the right time, he was one of the greatest generals in American, if not world history. And we all, you know, everyone in the U.S. owes an amazing debt of gratitude to him. It's incredibly lemming-like, very internally focused, a giant echo chamber. I really love not living in Silicon Valley so that I can maintain enough objectivity and external perspective.
Sorry, this isn't interesting. Silicon Valley's over. We're seeing Miami rise like never before. We're seeing decentralization of work, entrepreneurship. Do you think the Valley stronghold's losing its grip?
One of the things that drives me a little nuts about the Valley is they tend to take these very bold declarative statements. It values bold declarative statements. The Valley is over, or only the Valley matters, or, you know, I think the Valley is amazing at taking a data point of one and drawing a line, a trend line from it. But I think it's great for the world if we have a more democratic ecosystem for entrepreneurship. I'm super rooting for Europe. I know you're in Europe, and I love seeing European companies grow and thrive as well as all across the rest of the world and in the United States.
You've worked with many board members. Who's the most, not best, but who's the most memorable board member and why?
Well, I mean, Fred Wilson is the chairman of Etsy, and he's been an amazing partner for me. I do think that the Etsy board is a great board, and the reason is that they challenge us constantly. I mean, we have been a pretty successful company, and yet the board constantly challenges us in a way that I think is really helpful. They do it wanting us to win. It's not a gotcha. It's, hey, how do you think about this? I think that that constructive debate is super healthy.
What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you started at Etsy?
I think at the time I started, I wish I'd had a better understanding for where the employees were in terms of viewing Etsy's success versus challenges. Etsy faced a lot of challenges at that time, which caused us to go very fast and change a lot. And I think I assumed that employees were better grounded in all of the challenges Etsy faced than they actually were. And that caused us to have some catch up to do.
Yeah. And then tell me, most excitingly, what does the next 5 years hold for you and for Etsy? Paint that picture for me, Josh.
I think there's an implicit notion in the markets that there's going to be millions of individual places to buy things online. You know, if you're following the market cap of Shopify and Wix and Stripe and all of the other places out there, you know, the thesis must be that you're going to have millions of individual shops on the internet that are all trying to sell you stuff. I find that thesis exceptionally unlikely. The brain can only remember a couple of brands. And so I think the world is consolidating around fewer and fewer places to buy things online. I mean, if you're a tiny independent shop, you're going to count on Google or Facebook to drive all your traffic. And if you're downstream of Google and Facebook, they get all the economics and you can't really survive. So I think there's going to be only a tiny handful of places to buy things online. I think Amazon will continue to be the default for everyone in the Western world. And the more the world has a default, the more it yearns for an antidote to that default. And I think Etsy's incredibly well positioned to be the antidote to Amazon as the default.
It's interesting. So you think we're going to see the bundling of commerce in that respect, but then also the humanization of it away from, not away from, but as well as Amazon.
Look, we all need stuff that's going to arrive fast, ship cheap, and we'll have forgotten about it a minute after we used it, and then it's in a landfill. And that's going to happen. It's going to continue to happen. That's what you go to Amazon for. But I think the more that we shop there, the more we're desperate to feel something more human, to feel more connection with people. I think maybe we're going to want to buy fewer things, but have those things mean more. And that's what Etsy is. I think we stand for something fundamentally different than Amazon. And so I think we're really well positioned to be one of those few places left standing next to Amazon.
Josh, I absolutely love this. You can tell I've clearly asked practically no questions from the schedule, but it just drew my curiosity. So thank you so much for joining me, and I really do appreciate it.
It was great to talk. Thanks very much for the conversation.
I have to say that really was one of my favorite shows that I've ever recorded. You could tell that all of the questions were pretty much off schedule and just from my interest. Josh was incredibly tolerant of me going so deep there in terms of what happiness actually looks like, what vulnerability looks like as a leader. Josh was incredible. So huge thanks to Josh. And if you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, I have to say, I just love using AngelList fund admin platform to manage my investments with 20VC. The team and the platform with AngelList takes care of all my back office needs so that I can focus on working with great founders. Leading fund managers have made over 10,000 investments into 6,000 startups via AngelList, all online and all in one place. And with the recently announced rolling funds, you can easily find and invest in these top fund managers on angellist.com/rolling. And speaking of incredible products that allow you to do things that you simply didn't think were possible before, in 2021, every business is a global business. But how do you pay your global team and comply with international labor laws? Well, Remote handles payroll, benefits, taxes, and compliance to help companies of all sizes to pay and manage full-time and contract workers all over the world, no matter where your team lives and works. Remote's global employment solutions keep your team, your finances, and your IP secure. Remote never charges percentages or fees, just best-in-class global employment solutions for a low flat rate. The world's top companies love Remote. GitLab, the world's largest all-remote organization, trusts Remote to manage their global team, and Remote is funded by Index Ventures, Sequoia, and a host of other top-tier investors. I'm very proud to call myself a Remote investor. And ready to learn more? Well, visit remote.com/20VC today to download Remote's latest research report and start employing in minutes. And as I said, speaking of game-changing products with Remote to use at your company, we've all heard that time is money, and so Ramp says, why don't you save both? Ramp is the only spend management platform and corporate card that can really automate your accounting and lower your bills in under 15 minutes. That's even less than the 20VC podcast, my word. And Ramp allows you to streamline approvals, controlling spend before it happens. Ramp also has this awesome feature where it automatically identifies all active subscriptions and upcoming payments, allowing you to forecast in real time. For these and many more reasons, some of the best used Ramp, including 8 Sleep, Row, Founders Fund, and more. To join the revolution of saving both time and money with Ramp, head over to ramp.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and we have an incredible episode coming out with Andrew Dudham, founder and CEO at Hims on Thursday.